Hey, hi, good morning, everyone. It's so nice to be back at Midrash Yom Rishon to be able to learn with everyone together this morning. So our topic today is civil war, talking about rabbinic views concerning slavery. This, I think, is an interesting topic to kind of explore and develop together. So I hope we'll try to make this as interactive as possible and hear everyone's kind of opinions and thoughts as we go through these sources. So just by way of introduction, in the years leading up to the Civil War, as we know, one of the main issues really was slavery. And Jews were really on both sides of the conflict. You had abolitionists in the North, you had slaveholders in the South, and you had a real range of different views also existing in the middle. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at a lot of different rabbinic sermons and articles that were published at this time in the years in the 1860s. And hopefully by looking through these sources, we'll really get a sense of what the different viewpoints were and also how the different rabbis used Torah sources to support their opinions, whether this be, again, supporting one side or supporting the other, and really how they use different Torah sources in different ways to try to support their views. As we go through all this, something we're also going to spend some time discussing is also how the background and affiliation of each of these rabbis had an impact on their position. And again, this could be a difference between whether they affiliated Orthodox versus Reform, whether they had allegiances to the North versus the South, or even if they had a revolutionary upbringing in Europe that also could impact, again, whether they sided with the abolitionists or whether they sided more supporting slavery. So as we go through these sources and as we have this discussion, just a few other points to share before we actually dive right in. Number one, it's important to notice or to know that by this point in the 1860s, most people in America had kind of made up their mind. So the rabbinic positions that we're going to look at this time, they were really more of the followers than the leaders. At this point, really everyone had kind of made up their mind of where they stood on the concept of slavery. Additionally, there was no chief rabbi of America or no chief rabbi of the United States. So at this time, you didn't really have one rabbi who was speaking for everyone. And we'll see this is something that leads a little bit to controversy when different rabbis start to speak as if they are the person speaking for rabbinic jury of the United States. And this kind of leads to a lot of heated responses going back and forth when people feel that is happening. And again, just to think about the position of Jews in both the South and the North at this time. So, which was a little bit of a difference in their position. So, for example, Jews in the South were much more assimilated into Southern culture. And unfortunately, part of being assimilated into Southern culture meant a certain kind of acceptance of slavery, as uncomfortable kind of as that is to hear. And again, there were Jews who held slaves. Again, this doesn't seem to be in a disproportionate amount, according to scholars, and they weren't necessarily very involved in the slave trade. But again, these were Jews that part and parcel of kind of being accepted in the South, especially, and they were, you know, in different class systems. Unfortunately, also, the Jews more or less being, you know, belonging to different classes, they were considered a little bit more accepted than Jews were a little bit in the North. And this led, again, to this part of assimilating to Southern culture meant that more or less you would have this acceptance of slavery, as opposed to Jews in the North, who as immigrant outsiders were already kind of viewed with a little bit more of suspicion. So we'll see also how this plays out when we start to see different allegiances of the rabbis kind of on both sides of the conflict. So this brings us to our sources, and there was one event that kind of brought all of this conflict to the forefront. So in December in 1860, President Buchanan called upon all denominations to have this day on January 4th as a day of fasting and prayer, almost like a day where everyone would spend a day in tefillah, praying and fasting that the Union should stay together. So there was a rabbi in New York, Rabbi Morris Raphael, who was a rabbi. He'd originally been born in Sweden. He traveled from Sweden to Germany, to England, ending up in New York. And he was the rabbi of the Bnei Yeshurun Synagogue in New York, an Orthodox rabbi. And he decides to give a speech on the biblical view of slavery. After he gives his speech, it's published in newspapers, he publishes his sermon, and this leads to very heated responses from kind of all sides, depending on how they responded to different parts of his speech. So again, what we're going to do is look first at the text of his speech. We'll see a little bit what really was so controversial about it. He gets branded kind of because of this speech as the pro-slavery rabbi, And I invite you, as we look through the source, to decide for yourself, do we think this title is earned? Do we think that this is an exaggeration? Does it exactly seem to be what he is doing? And again, we'll see again as he goes through different arguments, as he argues for what he believes is the biblical view of slavery, we'll see how a lot of these aspects come in that we spoke about before, whether this be northern versus southern allegiances, or also kind of a distinction between reform versus orthodox polemics. So this is the first source in the source packet. And here again, the week before, he had heard a Christian preacher speak about about this topic of the biblical view of slavery, but taking an opposite approach and saying how Old Testament views against slavery were no longer necessary, we need to have a new morality. So he's coming in a little bit as a reaction to that. So what exactly is he going to do in this speech? So we'll start from the beginning, and he lays out that there are three questions that he's going to answer. So at the end of the first paragraph, in source number one, he says, "My investigation falls into three parts. First, how far back can we trace the existence of slavery? Secondly, is slaveholding condemned as a sin in sacred scripture? Thirdly, what was the condition of the slave in biblical times?" Right? So he's asking, first of all, is slavery sanctioned by the Bible? Is it considered a sin? And how are slaves treated, really, in the time period of Tanakh? So he starts off by answering that, by actually quoting some psukim, right, surrounding the Aseret HaDibrot, which talk about kind of the condition, not specifically about the condition of the slave, but on a tangent, kind of mention the idea of slaves. This is in paragraph 2. And he talks about how, yeah, this is the bolded part, even on that most solemn, most holy occasion, slaveholding is not only recognized and sanctioned as an integral part of the social structure, when it's commanded that the Sabbath of the Lord is to bring rest to Abdecha ve'amatecha, thy male slave and thy female slave. So he starts off by saying that once you open up your Tanakh, you open up your Chumash, it seems that slavery must be something that is sanctioned. Because it's mentioned right here in the Psukim concerning Shabbat, that you need to have your slaves rest as well. And again, almost that if this was something that was forbidden, why would the Torah, you know, mention it as something that we have to do? This doesn't seem to be something that's mentioned in a negative light. It's something that exists. You know, there are slaves, you have to have them rest. And he uses this as almost an example of slavery being sanctioned. So that's kind of his first move, that when you look through Chumash, there does seem to be the existence of this concept of slavery. And then in paragraph 3, he starts to get a little bit more intense about this. And I'm curious to hear kind of how we react, what our thoughts are to his reaction. So in paragraph 3, he starts to get a little more heated, and he says in the bold section, "How dare you denounce slaveholding as a sin?" So here he's responding again to people who say, right, that it's a terrible thing to own slaves. Don't worry, we're not, spoiler alert, we're not going to have this sheer come out being pro-slavery, don't worry. But here he's saying, you know, how dare you denounce slaveholding as a sin when you remember that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Job, the men with whom the Almighty conversed, we'll skip a little bit, that all these men were slaveholders. Does it not strike you that you're guilty of something very little short of blasphemy? So what's he saying over here? What's his next argument? Any thoughts? What's he saying in the statement? Exactly, right? The Avot, who were the Tzaddikim, they owned slaves. Isn't this tremendous? Isn't this an example of hubris to come and say, you know, oh, the Avos were terrible people? If we're saying that anyone who has a slave right now is a terrible person, that's a terrible accusation to levy against the Avot, who we know from Chumash, from Tanakh, also had slaves. So again, he goes from seeing slavery as something that's sanctioned, that exists in Chumash, right? Something that we're given laws to kind of determine, to jumping to this idea that, you know, anyone who accuses someone who has slaves as a sinner is basically accusing the Avot, right, of this terrible behavior. And then he takes it to the next point, and this is at the end of paragraph 3. He says, "And if you answer me, oh, in their time, slaveholding was lawful, but now it has become a sin. I, in my turn, ask you when and by what authority you draw the line. Tell us the precise time when slaveholding ceased to be permitted and became sinful." And here I think it's another interesting argument that he's putting forth, which is that it's perhaps this argument, this polemic here, it's not just about slavery for Rabbi Raphael, but it's a little bit more complex, this argument that people might make that, okay, slavery was okay in the time period of Tanakh, but now the times have changed, what else has to change? Right? The Torah or morality, that's a very loaded argument and not something that Rabbi Raphael, or especially in this time, an Orthodox rabbi, would be comfortable making. Right? Even if one is very uncomfortable with slavery, it's almost like a bigger argument or a bigger picture to come and say, and so this is what he's responding to over here, that if you're going to say times have changed and therefore morality has changed and perhaps this means the laws of the Torah have changed, that's not something that he's comfortable saying, especially if you remember this is a time where there are a lot of polemics going on, right, between the Orthodox and Reform movement, and this would be an argument that perhaps one would hear, you know, in different circles, that perhaps at that time of the polemic, he's not completely comfortable making this argument, even with something as terrible as slavery, right? And he says at the end, tell us the precise time when slaveholding ceased to be permitted and became sinful. This is true that times have changed. Why don't I see this in Chumash? Why don't I see this in Tanakh? Where's the point where it's spoken about, where it says that, okay, fine, later on, you're allowed to change this? So again, it's kind of a discomfort that he sees over this. He continues in paragraph 4, and here we see also that it's not just about kind of what Tanakh is talking, or what Chumash is talking about, or respecting the avot, or making sure that we're not gonna, you know, come and start changing everything, right? That perhaps he has that fear also, but there's a tremendous discomfort with what exactly might happen if the Union goes to war. And we're gonna see this in a number of different sources, especially for many Jews in the United States at this time. The United States was really a utopia. It was a place where they had religious freedom. This was not something that they always had in Europe. This was not something that they took for granted. And there was this tremendous fear that really, if the Union goes to war, if the United States has a civil war in this case, this could really put this, you know, whole experiment, this whole democracy of the United States in danger, and the Jews could lose this safe haven that they had. So one of the questions that we're going to see in the sources is how different rabbis balance how terrible they view this concept or the institution of slavery with, is it worth, slavery might be terrible, but is it worth going to war over this and risking everything we have in America? And that's something that we're going to see. For some rabbis, yes, this is the literal hill that we're gonna die on, that we are going to go to war over, something that as Jews we can't tolerate. Well, for others, that might be no. This is, the Union is something that comes before all, especially in a terrible case of a civil war, where you might have brothers fighting brothers, and not only Americans fighting Americans, but what could you end up having? Right? You could have Jews fighting Jews. And this is exactly, this might be something that people here are not, or different rabbinic leaders might not be comfortable with. And we see this in paragraph 4, where he says, what right have you to insult and exasperate thousands of God-fearing, law-abiding citizens whose moral worth and patriotism, whose purity of conscience and of life are equal to your own? Right? This whole idea of who are you to kind of accuse all these slaveholders, you know, all these terrible, terrible deeds. And again, we'll talk about at the end, you know, slavery is still very terrible. Did Raphael really know exactly what was going on? But here, it seems to be this concept of, are you really willing to go to war over this? You're going to make these accusations that he feels are unfounded when you see slaveholders also in the time period of Tanakh, right, especially the Avot. Is it really worth insulting all these citizens, right, of the South to lead us to war? So scholars later on say that it could be that Rabbi Raphael didn't really fully get kind of how terrible slavery was in the South, that perhaps he didn't fully understand the level of kind of the injustices that were going on, and perhaps if he did, he would have changed his position a little bit. But now what we see is, and this is again, I'm curious to hear your thoughts as we finish this source, is this discourse really something that is pro-slavery? Because now we'll see he takes a little bit of a different turn as he kind of wraps up his words. So in paragraph 5, he says explicitly that he is not here to defend slavery. Right? He says, I am no friend to slavery and still less friendly to the practical workings of slavery. He does not think slavery is lechatchila. He does not think that it's something that is ideal. It seems to be there's this concern really primarily here for avoiding war and not letting things escalate. And what he does now is he turns to kind of what his original third question was, which is, how are we really supposed to treat slaves when it comes to the Torah? He said that he believes that slavery is something that's sanctioned. Slavery is something that definitely existed in the time period of Chumash, that the Avot had. But what is basically the Torah
you on how to have slaves. So if we turn the page over, here, what he does is he differentiates a little bit between the concepts of an Eved Ivri and an Eved Kanani. I'm focusing much more right on a non-Jewish, a Canaanite slave, and a Jewish slave, focusing much more on the institution of an Eved Ivri. And he kind of posits, or he says that the Eved Ivri case is really supposed to be the ideal of how people are supposed to treat slaves. And he gives different examples, showing again how the position of the Eved Ivri, of the Jewish slave, is really very much protected and respected. So what are things that we know about the Eved Ivri that might show this? Very good. Slavery is not forever. After 7 years, you go free. Anything else? Very good. You have to give them time off. You have to allow them to rest. Very good, right? You have to respect, right, that who they bring in, allowing them the sense to have a family as well. So again, he kind of shows how in Jewish law, the slave is really seen as a person and not as property. What's a little bit more confusing and what you can push back at a little bit in this, I think, in his approach, is this works when you're talking about the Eved Ivri. It doesn't exactly work so much when you talk about the Eved Kanani, but he's trying, again, to just focus here more on the Eved Ivri. And what he says is, again, as everyone shared, and we'll see this at the top part of the second page, right, that, again, he is protected, right? We really make sure the Eved Ivri has a lot of rights. And he quotes the Rambam saying, it was a common saying which Maimonides has preserved for us, that he who buys a Hebrew bondsman gets himself a master, right? Taking here a quote from the Rambam, that, again, buying yourself a slave is really considered as if you bought yourself a master, because there's so many restrictions on how you can treat a slave. And he says over here, in fact, between the Hebrew bondsman and the southern slave, there is no point of resemblance. So again, what he's arguing over here is that there is a Torah-sanctioned way to do slavery or to do it correctly, but this is not what he sees happening in the South. In the South, it is not the Eved Ivri approach at all. And here he gets to kind of the final part of his argument, the next paragraph, and he says, the slave is a person in whom the dignity of human nature is to be respected. He has rights. Whereas the heathen view of slavery which prevailed at Rome, and which I'm sorry to say is adopted in the South, reduces a slave to a thing, and a thing can have no rights. And with this kind of argument, he then makes sort of a plea to both sides, asking for the extremists on both sides to kind of take a step back. And over here, I think, I don't know if we mentioned this before, but there's still also, we'll see this in other sources as well, there was a strong distrust sometimes of the abolitionists, especially from different Jewish groups. There was a fear that perhaps they were just doing it, they were warmongering, that, you know, their opinions weren't so much lishma, like they weren't just there to, you know, get rid of this sense of injustice. There also was concern of abolitionist ties to Christian evangelical groups, and again, that if the abolitionists would win, would the Jews be in a better position or not? So there really was this fear of the extremists on both sides. And we see this in the second last paragraph, where Rabbi Raphael makes a plea. And he says, if our northern fellow citizens, content with following the word of God, would not insist on being righteous overmuch, or denouncing quote-unquote sin, which the Bible knows not, they would entertain more equity and less ill feeling towards their southern brethren. And if our southern fellow citizens would adopt the Bible view of slavery and discard the heathen slave code, we'll skip a little bit to the end, if both north and south would do what is right, then God would mercifully avert the impending evil. And again, and he ends with kind of a tefillah to avert this calamity of civil war. So as we saw over here, really Raphael makes a few different arguments, whether it be saying that slaveholding definitely is something that's sanctioned by the Bible, it exists as an institution, right? Again, coming with the argument that people who accuse slaveholders of sinning are basically, it's a little bit of hubris, right? They're accusing by association the avot of sinning. He threw in also, right, this almost a polemic that he's not so comfortable saying times have changed, you know, so different laws have changed in the Torah. It's not something as an Orthodox rabbi he's comfortable saying, at least at this point. And then the argument that he is making that really everyone needs to kind of calm down. The North has to stop calling the South sinners because it's not exactly true, right? It's not really a sin in the Bible. And the South has to start doing slavery properly the way that it's supposed to be doing it, or the way that really you should be doing it according to laws of Tanakh, or really the laws of Chumash over here in the Torah approach. Thoughts or reactions to what Rabbi Raphael is making over here? Do you think he really is a pro-slavery rabbi or not? I'm curious to hear kind of what people are thinking before we look at the kind of very heated responses his published sermon encouraged in their response. Any thoughts? Yeah. Okay, interesting. So more kind of concerning like what is going on in the South and not kind of in general. Great. Any other thoughts or reactions? Yeah. Right. For sure. For sure. Right. Right. Almost kind of cherry picking the sources, right? They're like ignoring kind of how they got there. This wasn't someone who sold themselves into slavery because of debt or because of, you know, they're caught in a crime. For sure. Any other thoughts or reactions? Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Right. So what's interesting that you will see in the next few sources also how rabbis or leaders from states with strong economic ties to the South would really have that concern also, right? That it's an economic question, right? It's not just a morality question, which is makes it a little bit more complicated. So what's interesting is when the war does break out, first of all, just a response to a few things people said, a lot of scholars do make this argument that Rabbi Raphael did not really understand kind of how bad slavery was, and that there is a little bit of naivete when it comes to kind of his arguments. He didn't really fully understand how terrible it was. Once the war breaks out, he is fully on the side of the Union. His son actually fights for the North and loses his arm in battle, so he and his family definitely sacrificed, you know, for the cause. But at the time, once this sermon was published, there was a lot of heated response to it. And again, as we said before, this could also come from the fact that there wasn't a, you know, chief rabbi of the United States. So once one rabbi starts kind of publishing the Jewish view on slavery, lots of other rabbis from different denominations get very nervous. You know, you're not speaking for us. We don't believe this. So we'll look at some of the different responses. So one of the most outspoken responses to this was actually from, we'll look at two of them, were both from people who affiliated with the Reform movement. And I think it's interesting to look at over here when we have almost distinctions between Orthodox and Reform. Then we're going to come back to some Orthodox rabbis after. So we'll see exactly how all of this kind of plays together. So the first person is Michael Halperin, who was a journalist. He had a publication, different publications. So he kind of writes a few different responses over here to Rabbi Raphael's speech. And the first one over here we'll see in source number 2. And over here, what he kind of points out, which is interesting, is just the irony that he finds in Rabbi Raphael's speech of having someone who's Jewish say things that to him sound completely Egyptian, right? Completely kind of, especially when we think about, you know, how foundational Yetziat Mitzrayim is to us as Jews, and kind of how shocked he is to hear something that sounds, and again, it might not be pro-slavery, it might be pro, what, you know, defending what's going on in the South, where you could spin Rabbi Raphael's speech as just anti-war, right? But again, kind of the strong discomfort. And just to give you a couple of quotes, where he says, "Must the stigma of Egyptian principles be fastened on the people of Israel by Israelitish lips themselves?" And to quote in the last paragraph also, he makes this argument that, "Lastly, there is nothing sufficient to fasten the reproach of Egypt on the law of the great fugitive slave, who inaugurated his divine mission as liberator of a people of slaves by slaying one of their overseers, and who to the end of his career repeated over and over again, 'Forget not that you have been slaves in Egypt.'" Right? And saying that it's ironic for Rabbi Raphael to kind of attribute the Torah's position to being in favor of slavery, when Moshe Rabbeinu, right, the person who was instrumental in bringing down the Torah and teaching the Torah to the Jewish people, was the ultimate anti-slavery person, at least right in his eyes. So again, just kind of seeing that irony. And if we turn the page over, the next argument that's made, which I think is very interesting. We'll read it, then I'll just make a point on this. Is he argues that perhaps, here I think is where the question is, where do we put the concept of slavery when it comes to this debate of times are changing? We saw before that Rabbi Raphael was saying, you know, show me where it says that times have changed and therefore the laws have changed. And he was very uncomfortable saying that, right? And we saw that as kind of an orthodox kind of reform polemic. So the question that I think Friend kind of brings up here, and we're going to see in the next source as well, is where do we put slavery? Is it in the machloket of have times changed and now the laws change, and that's kind of like an orthodox reform polemic? Or is it something that perhaps you could also see in Chazal? Because he quotes over here something from the Gemara, also see in the Midrash, Lo dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara. That there are different times when Chazal pointed out that different mitzvot or different kind of areas of laws kind of in Chumash are ones that aren't exactly seen as ideal. You know, for one hand, you could think of examples, we'll see this a little bit later on, of Eshet Yifat Tohar, right, the war bride and how that's treated. That are these concepts something that is seen as ideal, or the Torah and God are giving dispensations to the weakness of human nature, right? But ideally, we're not really supposed to have to use this, and we're supposed to kind of overcome it. Whether this is, you know, examples of Eshet Yifat Tohar, we'll see after, even the Gemara later on is debated with the concept even of the death penalty. So again, the question is, where do we place slavery? Is it really in the times have changed, laws have changed, slippery slope kind of debate? Or is it more in, maybe this is one of those things that just because we have halachot about it, or the concept of it in Chumash, does that mean God really wants us to do this? Or is that if you listen, if you have to do it, here's the kosher way to do it. But ideally, perhaps you shouldn't be doing it. And that's something that we're going to see. It's a little bit unclear. And he exactly, right here, he gives this example, right? And they know that much was yielded by the law of Moses, the stubborn passions of man, of his people, of freed slaves, and of his time. You know the Talmudic, lo dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara. The law does not ignore the evil instinct. Kind of bringing up that example. So we're going to come back to that idea also, just a different way to frame it. The next source is Rabbi David Einhorn, who was a Reform rabbi in Baltimore. And interesting just a little bit about his background. So he's someone who came, first of all, a little bit about Baltimore at this time. So what's interesting is the Baltimore Jewish community was very split. On one hand, you had an older kind of German elite who all had strong economic ties to the South, right? And so because of this, right, had a lot of support for Southern slaveholding. And then you had recent Jewish immigrants from Germany, many of whom had been influenced by a lot of the revolutions going on in Europe, and who were much more on the side of the abolitionists, much harsher against, you know, in their critique of slavery. And Rabbi Einhorn kind of falls in that category. And what's interesting is, so he publishes a lot of kind of articles in Baltimore in his publication, which was called Sinai. And at a certain point, there's actually a riot by the older German elite who supported slavery, and they burned down his publication office, and he actually has to flee to Philadelphia. And when he gets to Philadelphia, the people, the Jewish community in Baltimore reach out to him, and they're like, okay, sorry about that. You can come back if you promise to not get political in any of your articles and sermons. So again, I guess rabbis don't really like to be told what to speak about in their sermons or articles. He said, no way, and he remains for the rest of his career in Philadelphia. And we'll actually see something that happens similarly to a different rabbi later on. And I think we can think about, you know, even, you know, in heated political climates, it's an interesting question of, you know, should congregants be allowed to tell their rabbis if they want to hear about politics, if they don't want to hear about politics? So it's not something new that we're dealing with today. It also goes back a little bit to this time. So Rabbi Einhorn kind of, again, he is someone who's coming from the Reform movement, but I think it's interesting some of the arguments he's making, going back to that question we said before, in that, is this really an Orthodox Reform polemic, or is this kind of a lo dibra Torah keneged yetzer hara, you know, God gives dispensations for human weakness, but it's not a lechatchila, it's not an ideal kind of system, you know, to have slaves or any other kind of category like that. Where exactly do we put slavery? So he starts off kind of also asking this question about, you know, the question is in source number 3. The question exclusively to be decided is whether Scripture merely tolerates its institution as an evil not to be disregarded, and therefore infuses in its legislation a mild spirit gradually to lead to its dissolution, or whether it favors, approves of, and justifies and sanctions it in its moral aspect. Right? Is slavery b'di'eved or lechatchila? Is it ideal or not ideal? And then he gives kind of different examples of other categories of things in Chumash. And the first example he gives is polygamy, right? going back to Rabbi Raphael's argument, Rabbi Raphael had said, you know, how could you, if you say that slaveholding is a sin, that means you're saying the Avot are sinners. And he says, well, wait a second. Like, the Avot lived in a different time period. They did things that, you know, we wouldn't do today. You know, can you really make that argument, though? For example, the Avot, you know, were, many of them had, you know, multiple wives. It's not something we would do today. Again, I don't think that means we're calling them sinners, right? They lived at a time when that was appropriate, but it's unclear if you can then make that argument to say, you know, oh, but that it must be okay today also. Because you wouldn't say that, he's saying over here, you wouldn't say that about polygamy, so why are you comfortable saying that about slavery, right? In the bold, he says, is a justification of an institution. Here, talking about polygamy, the immorality of which Dr. Raphael will scarcely deny, and whose propagation Rabbeinu Gershon sought to check through a ban, not here affirmed in the most positive manner. Right? So, like, we don't say that polygamy is a good thing just because people did it in the time period of Tanakh. It's something that we have takanot that have prescribed it or limited it, right? At least in Ashkenazic communities, kind of going through generations. He gives another example. It must be conceded that the Mosaic law, as in the case of the blood vengeance and the marriage of a war prisoner, here merely tolerated the institution in view of once existing deeply rooting social conditions, or more correctly, evils, and recognized it in reference to civil rights, even, but never approved of it or considered it pleasing in the sight of God. And what I thought was very interesting about this source is just, again, going back to that kind of way of viewing it, it gives a few other examples. You have polygamy, the blood vengeance right here is talking about the concept of the Goel Hadam, right? In the case of accidental murder, or sometimes even in an actual murder, are the relatives of the victim allowed to take justice into their own hands? And again, the concept of Eshet Yefat Toar, right, where again, we allow soldiers in certain cases, right, to kidnap or to take women in battle. And again, these are all institutions that are heavily kind of, say, kind of halachasized or heavily kind of, you know, given many details of how exactly it has to be done. For example, we know in Eshet Yefat Toar, right, there's a lot of limitations that are placed on it. It's almost the Torah is, you know, allowing this to, if you have to do this, here's the way to do it, right? And you have to let her grow out her hair, you have to let her mourn her family, there's very strict laws around it. In the Gemara in Makot, in Masachan Makot, it talks a lot about the concept in the second parak of the Goel Hadam, of the blood avenger, and there's a lot of discussion and debate amongst the rabbis of whether or not this is something that is a chiyuv. Does the Goel Hadam have to kill the person if they find them, you know, outside the Ir Miklat, outside the city of refuge? Is it optional? Is it something that perhaps only they should do after the court, after the Beit Din, has found this person guilty? And what's interesting, kind of looking through this parak and looking through that parak in Masachan Makot, it's a little bit of, the rabbis are in a little bit of a different place at this point, right? In Masachan Makot, you have a Sanhedrin, you have Beit Din. There's a little bit of discomfort of allowing kind of a blood avenger, of allowing the Goel Hadam to take justice into their own hands when we have a Beit Din and Sanhedrin. Maybe it made sense in time period of Tanakh, right, when you could think about the story, right, of Shimon and Levi, right, where tribal justice, that's the only way you'd be able to have justice. What we see in Masachan Makot is there's almost like a move by Chazal, by the rabbis, to kind of bring this into play with the Beit Din and with the Sanhedrin. Now, we're a little bit uncomfortable with people taking the law into their own hands. And again, which category does that work into? We're not saying things don't apply anymore at all, but were these things ever l'chatchila, you know, or was it on the books that if you needed to use this? But later on, kind of people don't really feel as neat, kind of with Eshet Yefat Toar also. And the final example I'll give also is the death penalty, which is also discussed in the Gemara in Masachat Makot. There are some rabbis, right, who say if you don't use the death penalty, then society will be chaos, right, there's going to be anarchy, people won't fear punishment. But Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon say, had they been on Sanhedrins that judge death penalty cases, they would never have been comfortable executing anyone. So it's also an interesting question of, you know, but it says in Chumash, you know, if you do certain things, mochumach, or that people should lose their life. But again, you know, is this something that is there if we need it, but we're allowed to move away or not? And the question is, where exactly do we put slavery? To come back to kind of the source, and we'll kind of move into other sources also as you move through the packet. So Rabbi Einhorn kind of goes on at the end. He says, you know, a book which sets up this principle, right, he's talking over here of Tzelem Elokim, right, God created man in his image, at the same time says that all human beings are descended from the same human parents, can never approve of slavery and have it find favor in the sight of God. Another interesting argument, I think, which is, what about internal Jewish ethics, right? On one hand, in Chumash, we have the laws of how to treat slaves and the institution of slavery, but we're also told that everyone's created B'Tselem Elokim, right? So how do we kind of balance those two different values that we see. Finally, kind of moving away from the religious, ideological arguments and going back to the politics, what's interesting over here is I think we see in Rabbi Einhorn also this idea of this great fear that war might risk the amazing kind of opportunities and democracy that exists in the United States, and that's given such privilege and such protection to the Jewish community. Rabbi Raphael was not really so willing to risk it. Here we see a little bit of a different approach when it comes to Rabbi Einhorn. He says over here, this is in the, if you turn the page over, paragraph 4, the Jew has special cause to be conservative, and he is doubly and triply so in a country which grants him all the spiritual and material privileges he can wish for. He wants peace at every price and trembles for the preservation of the Union like a true son for the life of a dangerously sick mother. And again, the sense that, you know, we really have to be very careful in risking the United States, especially in how great it's been for the Jewish community. But unlike other approaches, Rabbi Einhorn's approach is that Jews will never be fully protected in the United States as a minority as long as slavery exists. As long as other people are not being treated equally, we cannot guarantee that the Jewish community will ever truly be safe. Right? Other arguments might say, okay, maybe we can tolerate slavery in order to preserve the Union, but for him, he's not really willing to make that argument, and we'll see that in a few other sources as well. And even for him, just in the next source also, kind of for him, he sees this almost as something as a malik, you know, of what's going on in the South, especially the concept or the real kind of reports and stories that are coming out of the South of how slaves are really being treated in this very barbaric way. However, to kind of see what we've seen so far, right? We've seen kind of Rabbi Raphael's speech, again, kind of coming from the North. We've seen the abolitionist view, right, with Einhorn and with Halperin. So I want to kind of, we're going to see a few middle approaches also, but I wanted to point out was, what about the rabbis in the South? Where are the rabbis in the South on this? How do kind of they deal with even the cognitive dissonance of both the, you know, both the morality that they should have or feel right in the Torah, but also kind of what's going on around them? So what's interesting in source number 5, we have another kind of speech from Rabbi Bernard Eloi. So in this case, Rabbi Bernard Eloi was an Orthodox rabbi. He was also from the Jewish community in Baltimore, but he was from the older German elite that had economic ties to the South. And here, he kind of takes a little bit of a different view. And here we see like a strong distrust of the abolitionists and their warmongering and what they're trying to cause, and kind of a defense of the rights and the independence of Southern citizens. It's not really talking so much about slavery. He conveniently kind of doesn't focus on that, but really a sense of, and we spoke about this before, Jews living in the South feeling strong connections to the Southern community, really wanting to defend that. And he says over here, who can blame our brethren of the South for seceding from a society whose government cannot or will not protect the property rights and privileges of a great portion of the Union against the encroachments of a majority misguided by some influential, ambitious aspirants and selfish politicians? So he's not mincing words over here, right? Seeing the abolitionists as having their own kind of intentions over here, that they're not really doing it lishma, or they're not doing it for the right reasons, and wanting to protect Southern society. And he gives another interesting argument going back to Chumash, the next paragraph. He says, if it's true that really God was not a fan of slavery and that eventually we were supposed to move away from it, there were many opportunities in Chumash, in Tanakh, for people to free the slaves. And it never happened. Right? And he gives the example over here that, first of all, in the second paragraph, he says, if Moshe was so anti-slavery before the Jews went to Eretz Israel, before his death, why didn't he get up and say everyone should free their slaves? And he says in the bold section, where was there ever a greater philanthropist than Abraham, and why did he not set free the slaves which the king of Egypt made him a present of? Right, Abraham's given slaves, he doesn't free them. Why did Ezra not command the Babylonian exiles who, when returning to their old country, had in their suit 7,337 slaves to set their slaves free and send them away? Also Ezra. So again, this kind of idea that maybe, but again, you could always challenge back that, okay, that's not where society was at that time, and it took a little bit of time. But challenging that if this is something really that should have been done, then it should have been done by the Avot, it should have been done by other leaders like Ezra and Moshe. So again, something to think about. And one other kind of rabbi coming from the South in source 6, we turn the page over, so Rabbi Max Michelbacher, who was a rabbi in Richmond, Virginia, an Orthodox rabbi, actually wrote a tefillah for the Confederacy. What's interesting here, if you read kind of through the tefillah that he has, he also kind of shares, or we can see kind of like within this tefillah, different hints of a lot of the views that existed in the southern community that Jews who were assimilating this community had as well. For example, right, he says as part of his tefillah, the manservants and the maidservants that was given unto us, the enemy are attempting to seduce, and that they too may turn against us, whom thou hast appointed over them as instructors in thy wise dispensation. So a couple of points that I draw out here, like number one, there seems to be this fear that the enemy are attempting to seduce of slave rebellions. And there was always kind of a lot of talk that, wait a second, maybe the slaves are going to rebel, we have to keep them under control. So we see that kind of alluded to here. And also, the idea that unfortunately existed in the South, which was that slaveholding was something that was positive, it was to civilize the slaves. If it wasn't for slavery, these were, you know, savages, and we had to come and civilize them. And again, things are, you know, very disturbing and comfortable to read. This idea of appointed over them as instructors in thy wise dispensation, again, for some people, especially perhaps people who didn't really see the barbaric impact of slavery directly in front of them, you know, perhaps this was something that was easy or convenient to believe, you know, that we are civilizing the slaves. It's not a bad thing. It's we're helping them, right? So again, kind of different opinions seen that were very much reflective, not any different than what people were saying in the South. So we've seen kind of the abolitionist approach, we saw the Southern approach, and now we'll see kind of like a middle approach or middle ground as we kind of wrap up our time together. So I want to look at a few, two final rabbis, Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss and also Rabbi Sabbata Moraes, who both have kind of interesting approaches. So to show kind of the middle approach, and I think we've alluded to this already, Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, so this is in source 7, he was also a reform rabbi in Cincinnati. Cincinnati, going back to the politics, was a state with a strong economic connection to the South. So again, a lot of kind of allegiances here in the South. So here we're moving into the political approach. And here, he was someone who, interesting enough, felt that politics had no kind of role in his sermons or in his publication, The Israelite. He didn't like to talk about politics, even though later on he was actually convinced to run for office. But again, he didn't really want to debate slavery. He never officially kind of responds to Raphael's speech or Raphael's sermon, right, the pro or pro-slavery quote-unquote discourse. But here, he really comes down into the argument that nothing is worth risking the Union, that the Union really comes before anything else. And okay, slavery is bad, but we should be willing to tolerate it just to preserve the Union. Right? And he points out over here something that I think many Jews perhaps felt at this time as well, who were in the middle. I'll just read the bolded part. We do not know by what policy, compromise, or amendments this can be effective easiest and quickest, but we know and feel that the storm must abate and the Union must be maintained. We have to protect the United States, the Union, the role of the Jewish community within it as much as we can. And he goes on in source 8, and I think people pointed this out before, that we cannot, not only because we abhor the idea of war, but also we have dear friends and near relations, beloved kinsmen in either section of the country. Therefore, silence must henceforth be our policy. Right? And as we said before, it's not just as a civil war. This could be a, right, Milchamed Achim in the very literal sense of Jews in the north fighting Jews in the south. And according to this source, right, he really is willing to say, no matter how bad slavery is, we're going to choose silence. Because the war, you know, the war basically is the greater of these evils, and we're not willing really to risk this. So before we look at the final source, I'm just curious kind of reactions so far. We've seen kind of the abolitionists, we saw this kind of middle approach that's willing to perhaps tolerate the evils of slavery in order for the war to not happen. Anything that's surprising or any comments people have on this? Any thoughts? They teach you in teacher school to like wait like a minute for people to give you some wait time. Any thoughts or reactions to these sorts? Anything surprising? Yeah. For sure. No, I hear, and it's an interesting question, right? That like this is something that unless you really saw like the slave holding in front of you, it may be just more of an abstract political issue, right? And are you willing to speak about this politically as a religious leader and risk losing your job, right? We saw over here, we're going to see it with the next source also, rabbis, both Orthodox and Reformed rabbis, who were kicked out of their pulpits and had to flee, right? Because the congregation didn't like what they were saying, or right, didn't want them to speak about uncomfortable topics, which is an interesting separate thing to think about, right? That like, how do we view the role of religious leaders? Are they there to, you know, give musar, to share, to talk about politics if it's an ethical issue, or is it just too complicated and we'd rather they just talk about the parsha, right? So it's an interesting debate. So the final source I want to show you is Rabbi Sabato Moraes. He's a very fascinating rabbi. So he was an Italian-American rabbi. So he came from Italy, he went to England, he ends up in Philadelphia. And he was a rabbi who was traditional, he was Orthodox. He actually had a lot of polemics against the Reform movement. He thought they were going too far in changing things. But then his response to that, though, was to end up, he was one of the rabbis involved in the founding of JTS, or the Jewish Theological Seminary. So again, he was someone who, though personally in his life, affiliated, I would say, more on the Orthodox side. Something that's also fascinating about him is all of his sermons were encrypted up until not so long ago, that he actually wrote all his sermons in like shorthand and nobody could read them. And now I think at University of Pennsylvania, people figured out, like a lot of scholars finally figured out the code and they are kind of cracking it and publishing his sermons in English. So now you can actually access them in English. Before that, he wrote them all in like secret code. This is actually from, I gave some sources in the back, if you're interested in looking into this more. It's called actually the Encrypted Sermons of Rabbi Moraes. So fascinating things. And what's interesting is he was someone who also was strongly impacted by his revolutionary background. His father was actually jailed in Italy for trying to overthrow the government, right, in the sense of fighting for injustice. And because of this, we see two things in his speech. On one hand, we see a strong love of the United States, and similar as before, wanting to preserve that. But on the other hand, because of his revolutionary background, and also I think because of the morals and ethics he sees in the Torah, he's not willing to tolerate slavery, and he says this is something we fight over. This is something that we speak out against. I think it's interesting because I know when I was researching this, I was a little bit, you know, I think it's also, you know, comforting to see more people on the, you know, Orthodox side, right, who are also finally speaking out over here, right, against slavery. And he's also very poetic in his speech. So we'll just read this final source. He says, "I stood with my mind on the summit of Pisgah to survey this land of promise, which has beckoned to this land of promise the weary and the oppressed. I've been permitted to enter this new Canaan," right? He calls the United States like the new Eretz Yisrael, "every spot of which is sanctified by the footsteps of revolutionary heroes." We'll skip down to the end. "O land, 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 Eretz, 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 thy prosperity has seduced thy way from the path marked out by the noble founders. Therefore hath trouble befallen thee. Degeneration fostered by luxury, corruption engendered by satiety has conspired against thee," etc., etc. He's very poetic. And again, we see here that he's really blaming this kind of like reliance on economy. And again, as we saw earlier, there was like a distrust of the abolitionists, right, and their motives. So here, he's flipping it on the South, right, and he's saying, maybe our reliance on the economic slaveholding is not a positive thing. Maybe that's led us to the brink of war, of risking the future of this new Canaan, of this new Eretz Canaan. And then he goes on in source 10, and this is also just something I thought was very funny, so I included it. He says, "Not here." He's celebrating when slavery is finally abolished in Maryland. And he says, "Not the victories of the Union, but those of freedom, my friends, do we celebrate. What is Union with human denigration? Not I, the enfranchised slave of Mizraim. Cast then your vision yonder, and behold the happy change wrought by the hand of Providence. Thy name shall no longer be called Maryland, but Maryland, for thou hast verily breathed a joyous spirit into the souls of all thy inhabitants," right? And again, just seeing kind of like how he viewed this as a, you know, almost religious thing that we had to fight to get slavery overturned. And again, what's interesting is he actually gets banned from speaking for a few months by his congregants because they are also not happy that he is clearly coming down on, you know, one side, very against slavery. But then he kind of figures it out. And that's the final source, right? In source 11, "Men would have stopped my speaking altogether, but I appealed to my constituents and after 3 months' silence, renewed my free speech as formerly." So again, rabbinic politics, just back then, just as today, right? People, again, we see kind of, you know, do we let the rabbi speak or not? Is not something that is a new issue. To kind of wrap all of this up and to summarize, I think this is, for me personally, a fascinating topic because there's so many different aspects that are kind of intertwined in analyzing this, right? We spoke a little bit about, first of all, what exactly does Chumash say about this issue? Is this something that's seen as ideal? Is it something that's seen as a concession to human weakness? How exactly do we think, you know, is it fair to kind of say things about the Avot when they lived in a certain time? Can we learn lessons out from that to then impact the morality of today? We saw how, first of all, there's almost a religious aspect, the Orthodox Reform polemic, right? Are we comfortable saying times have changed, laws have changed or not? And then the other question of perhaps slavery doesn't even belong in that discussion, but it's an internal Chazal discussion of, is this in the category of the Goel Hadam, of the Eshet Yifat Tor, of execution of death penalty controversies, of polygamy, which are kind of items that, you know, that the Torah kind of offers as a concession, but maybe over time, it's not something that's seen as ideal, and perhaps slavery belongs in that field. We also spoke about how politically, you know, it depended whether you trusted the abolitionists more, or sorry, you mistrusted the abolitionist view, or whether perhaps you mistrusted the economic ties with the South. And again, how one common theme throughout all these rabbis was how precious they viewed the United States and the protection that it offered the Jewish community, and how were we really willing to risk all of this to get rid of slavery? For some people, yes, and for some people, no. And I'll end with a quote from Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, just going back to the question of, wait a second though, like how is it that slavery is a thing, right, in the Torah or in Chumash? And he provides kind of what I thought was a very interesting approach as to why God kind of allows slavery and does not kind of come out at a certain point explicitly saying, okay, but this year, you have to get rid of it. And I'll just read this together. He says, he does not abolish it, but he so circumscribes it that he sets in motion a process that will foreseeably, even if only after many centuries, lead the people to abandon it of their own accord. And Rabbi Sacks goes on, he gives examples, which I think people shared originally, that some of the laws surrounding the Eved Ivri, that it's not forever, it's only for 7 years, right, then you have to go free. The fact that, you know, there's a option perhaps for a family, the fact that you can't injure them, but they're not considered property, that all of these are hints that God was kind of putting into the system that this is not ideal. This is not, like, if you have to do it, fine, but this isn't something that you're really, that I really want you to be doing. But we'll go to the bold and at the end. Why choose this way of doing things? Because people must freely choose to abolish slavery if they are to be free at all. God can change nature, says Maimonides, but he cannot or chooses not to change human nature, precisely because Judaism is built on the principle of human freedom. So he could not abolish slavery overnight, but he could change our choice architecture, or in plain words, give us a nudge, signaling that slavery is wrong, that we must be the ones to abolish it in our own time through our own understanding. It took a very long time indeed in America, not without a civil war, but it happened. There are some issues on which God gives us a nudge, the rest is up to us. So again, fascinating and very bold, I think, statement here by Rabbi Sacks about how we view Torah, how we view human responsibility, and really a lot to think about. Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to continue the conversation if people have questions, and have a great day. Yeah.
or from the preservation of the Union, because at that point we'd taken that for granted. But the preservation of the Union was pretty young at that point, it was an experiment. And it was an experiment that was really good to do. And that was like more important than the underlying principle. And I don't know how much of it was really injustice.
Okay, because I think, to me, especially if you want to relate to the larger community, yeah, even outside the shore.
Right. Don't talk about Jews.
That's
no,
right.
No, Mike,
that's right. And it's like, it almost could be counterproductive because you can say, well, the Jews are going to take their own slaves.
Wow.
The other slaves, so they're partners, and the other slaves isn't very, you know, convincing because they don't care about, you know, the other slaves. They're not so
well,
I understand
that. Yeah, I'm going to go look it up.
I don't know if it's true. And that's a little up on the limitations of it. But it seems that they both through limitations. And also, they still had to go to the rest, even though they weren't there. Living accommodations from other places. Although they weren't going out to the east.
Yeah, you're inspiring me to go look up
the street. Yeah, they were really surprised that they would move out of North Carolina. Because they could say, well, we have our rules of our definitions. Even for the
end.
So thank you very much.